across the galaxy. This is where conspiracy on the wild side meets the perspective of a lifetime. This is the Free Zone with your host, Freeman.
Hello and welcome to the Free Zone. Well, if you ever wondered what it was like when Ken Kesey met Timothy Leary, well, tonight you might get a little taste of what that's like, only now in the 21st century. Moving far beyond from where the hippie movement had started, we're going to go deep into consciousness studies today. Looking at paradigm-changing model of consciousness, trying to understand, can consciousness exist without a living organism? Tonight, we're talking with Anthony Peake. He's a writer. He's on the borderline of human consciousness. He's attended the London School of Economics, is a member of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, the Scientific and Medical Network, and the Society for Psychical Research. His books deal with this paradigm-changing hypothesis of the idea that he calls cheating the ferryman. Is There Life After Death is one of his most immortal books that really propelled Anthony out into the public eye. He's followed this up with 9 other works, including A Life of Philip K. Dick, The Man Who Remembered the Future, The Daemon, A Guide for Your Extraordinary Secret Self, including The Labyrinth of Time and Opening the Doors of Perception, The Key to Cosmic Awareness. Please welcome the wonderful and amazing Anthony Peake to the Free Zone. It's so great to have you here, Anthony.
And I'm so excited about this. It's going to be a fascinating couple of hours of that, I'm absolutely sure.
I agree. So you've got the Funzing conference coming up here on February 26th. I wanted to get a little bit of promotion out there. That's Bristol. And you're going to be discussing a lot of your new work that's coming out, which is Through the Doors of Perception. Is this right?
Yeah, the actual Bristol conference took place last week. Oh. But there is another Funzing conference discussing opening the doors of perception and the latest work I'm doing, which will be in Shoreditch in central London. Tickets are also already going fast in terms of this, so we're probably expecting well over 100 people, probably. And this will be me discussing the latest work I'm doing in terms of, and something you're probably going to be fascinated in, is the idea of when we are in altered states of consciousness, when you're in the DMT zone, these kind of things, alien abductions or whatever, what is the status of the entities that we come across in these circumstances? Are they just extensions of our own subconscious, or do they have independent existence? And if they do have independent existence, how do we isolate that independent existence scientifically and neurologically? And I'm really excited with some of the information I'm already generating in terms of this. So it's going to be a fascinating evening that we're doing. But another event we're doing that you might be interested in, or the guys out there might be interested in, is at the end of April, we'll be doing an event at the Drakelow Caves in the Midlands in the UK, a place called Kidderminster. And these caves, they're around about 5 miles of underground passageways that were actually probably carved out during the Second World War, in the early years of the Second World War, by the Rover Industrial Company. And these caves have now been derelict for many, many years. In fact, they were only declassified around about 5 or 6 years ago. And I am told from psychologist friends and researcher friends that it's probably one of the most haunted, in raised commas, areas of the UK, because there's poltergeist activity down there and there's lots of other very, very strange phenomena taking place there. And we're going to be taking 2 groups of people down there. Now, we've got Dr. David Luke involved, who is a psychologist at University of Greenwich. We are going to have lucid light devices with us, which I will discuss in greater detail later if you want, and also a series of Brian Geisen dream machines. We're also going to be using virtual reality. We'll have virtual reality headsets. And we're also doing a lot of ambient music as well. So it's going to be a full sensory recreation of the Eleusinian mysteries, the ancient Greek mysteries, of the pre-Socratics. So very, very exciting, these events that are coming up. All of them will be on my website, on my Facebook page. But if anyone wants to check them out, try and get along. It's going to be really, really cool.
Fantastic. And that is, folks, anthonypeake.com. Of course, it'll be linked right here to the article so that you can just go right over and check it all out. That sounds fascinating. We're moving into new paradigms right now, Anthony, where life is changing quicker than most people can keep up with. And as you know, even peer-reviewed articles don't seem to make a mark in anyone's attention because people don't think about thinking.
That's so true. As we were saying earlier on when we were chatting, you know, the thing is that there are people who dig deeply into the mystery of being a conscious entity within what seems to be a physical reality external to ourselves. But people don't go much further than that. They don't actually go into, well, why is it? What exactly am I? Am I my ego? Am I something deep within myself? Am I in some way my personality and my everything I that is about me is being downloaded from somewhere else? Is consciousness a field? Because one of the great problems facing modern science is something called the hard problem of consciousness. Way back in 1999, a young Australian philosopher, hippie philosopher, by the name of David Chalmers, stood up at a conference at the University of Arizona and turned around and said that modern science has the soft problem, which is how the brain works. But the hard problem of modern science is how effectively inanimate matter reacting with electricity creates self-consciousness, self-awareness. Where does it come from? We're talking about two very different things here. And until we understand how that magic takes place, we are not even at first base of really understanding how the universe really functions. Because the only thing that you and I and everybody that's listening knows with any certitude is that you're something perceiving something. Everything else is just created by your consciousness, created by your brain, presented to your consciousness within your head from information that's coming in through your senses. But that in itself is such an amazing process. And science is starting to now try to understand these greater problems. And a lot of quantum physics now is moving into these areas. Cosmology is moving into these areas, and even neurochemistry and neurology, which are always the last things to move in terms of this. The quantum physicists have already realized and have probably known since the mid-1920s there's something inherently strange about reality. But the thing is, with biologists and with people who deal with brain processes, they're still very much locked into the materialist reductionist paradigm that everything can be understood by taking it apart. But of course, in the brain, that doesn't work. You know, you take apart the brain, you take apart the brain processes, you end up with a total mystery because you can't take the brain apart and suddenly find bits of consciousness within the neurons because it just doesn't happen that way. And this is the exciting times we now live. And I think the times are now really challenging. We have environmental problems, we have sociological problems, we have political problems, but we also have these wonderful opportunities whereby we're now in a position to start to think differently about what consciousness is. We have virtual reality now that can make us realize that what we take to be external reality could be some form of creation. I mean, we mentioned earlier on before we started the interview about people like Elon Musk, but a lot of these guys are starting to realize that there's something deeper going on here. Are we in a simulation? If we are in a simulation, who's creating it? These are the big questions.
Yeah, one thing that really fascinates me, Anthony, is the idea of mind transfer technologies. We have a group called the Blue Brain Project.
Yeah.
And they are attempting to create a supercomputer-based reconstruction of a rat brain.
Mm.
And of course, this began, around 2006, they started putting these simulations out and putting out their information. But this idea that you could take your consciousness and transmit it into a circuitry board, into a computer, and have life still a transfer that you could possibly then send to a clone. I mean, this is the 21st century thinking that we have going on, but people are creating simulated neurons.
Well, it's the big question here, isn't it? It's called the substrate problem. And it's the idea that if you were able to, for instance, scan my brain down to the molecular level and recreate the information that is contained in there digitally and then upload that into a computer, would that be me? Would that have everything that makes me me? And of course, the answer is probably it wouldn't. Purely and simply because we're confusing the map with the territory here. Just because, for instance, certain parts of the brain fire up when certain stimuli are taking place. For instance, they've been able to reproduce, for example, if somebody is playing tennis, they've done brain scans of people and MRI scans of somebody playing tennis. Then they've asked somebody to imagine playing tennis. And the same parts of the brain light up. So therefore, it is assumed that there's a general one-to-one relationship between these two. But it's not necessarily the case. There could be reasons that areas of the brain may light up because they're being stimulated externally. In other words, it's not the brain itself reacting, but it's reacting from somewhere else. I mean, I'm not original in this, but I very much used this analogy in the past. Of the thing is, if you had one of the old radios from many years ago that actually had the little lights in the back, and the diodes and everything else, you would assume from the lights going on and off, if you take the back off, that in some way the signal or the studio that's broadcasting the program is in the back of the radio. And you would notice that certain parts of the radio light up when certain things take place, and you'd somehow believe that to be what is going on in the studio. But the studio is many, many miles away. So effectively, you're confusing the two things. And I think in many ways, this is what happens with the brain. Now, for instance, if you did manage to create a reproduction of Anthony Peake and you uploaded it into a computer and it spoke like me and it reacted like me, but it could still be what the philosophers call a zombie. Just because it seems to act as if it is intelligent or seems to act as if it has self-aware consciousness doesn't mean that it really has. I think it was John Searle, a philosopher, that came up with the idea of, I think it was the Chinese room problem, that you could have a computer that could actually use the Chinese language. And it would seem that it knew the language, but of course it's just a program. It's a series of algorithms that react in certain ways to certain stimuli, but it doesn't mean it has independent conscious existence. But then again, it's one of the greatest problems of philosophy, isn't it? How do we ever know that anybody else, that anything is going on between their eyes? We don't. I know it's dangerous solipsism here, but we can't really ever know. You know, effectively, we could be all still in a dream sequence now. We could be dreaming, and effectively, the reactions of everybody around us are already part of our greater dream. You know, and we couldn't know. We don't know because we can't. But it's an interesting area, and I know that some of the work that's being done now in terms of how information works, and I mean, recently they've discovered some fascinating stuff about information, that information actually has energy involved in it. Information generates heat. So suddenly we're discovering that information is effectively similar to the second law of thermodynamics. You know, that energy can never be destroyed. It can only be changed. And the same comes with information. So suddenly we're starting to realize that what we think is actually a physical reality external to ourselves may be actually built by digital information, by binary code, for want of a better term. So these are really big questions. And we are really at the precipice now of some great, great changes in terms of how we think. It's a huge paradigm change. You know, it's very much going back to the old idea of Thomas Kuhn and his philosophy of paradigms. It seems that the seeds of the next paradigm are already in this one, and we're moving forward. But we have to break away from this preoccupation with materialist reductionism. Materialist reductionism is a wonderful model of science. The reason that you and I are able to communicate now is because of materialist reductionism. But it doesn't answer everything. There are things it cannot answer. And we have to start looking into those altered states of consciousness. We have to look into precognitions. We have to look into remote viewing. We have to look into out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences. And these things, because these are the ones that will give us the clues as to where we need to go. They will point us in the direction of the next great change in terms of human understanding.
And it's all really begins there at a personal level, when you start to realize that your mind is saying things that you're not thinking, it's asking you questions that are seeming from elsewhere. Where does information even come from? How do we come up with ideas and thoughts? And like you, I believe, a lot of my thoughts on all of this started very young, and the idea is because I suffered heavy migraines. And when I would suffer these migraines, I would find myself as a child putting myself into this small space inside of my consciousness where it didn't hurt. And I knew that if I at any moment thought about my body or thought about the situation I was in, I would feel all that pain. But I could stay in this little space inside of myself that didn't feel the pain and just ride it out as my body suffered through the trauma.
That's interesting, isn't it? The idea that we can, by taking, because one of the great areas of analysis in terms of consciousness is the question of attention. You know, we attend to things, and because we attend to things, we are more aware of them. And effectively what I guess you were doing when you were younger there was forcing yourself to not attend to the pain and think yourself out of the pain into another location mentally and another place where the pain wasn't immediate. But of course, when we start, even the concept of pain is something, and when I discuss this with people who don't tend to think deeply enough, and they misunderstand what I say here, when I turn around and I say, well, pain is nowhere. In effect, if there were no sentient beings, there are no feeling creatures in the universe, pain wouldn't exist. Pain is a qualia. Pain is something that we perceive, that our nerves, and all it is the nerves being stimulated in a particular way that creates this feeling of pain. But again, on a moment's reflection here, why is pain unpleasant? And it's a question, rather like yourself, when I was very young, I used to ask myself these questions. What is it about pain that is unpleasant? Why is it unpleasant? And people look at me even now when I say this and they go, well, it just is. But why is it? Why does that sensation be unpleasant when, for instance, you know, to be coarse about this, you know, an orgasm has many elements of a painful situation, yet it is extremely pleasant. And then we have the same question as why is it so pleasant when it has its root cause and sources in the same thing? Maybe this is getting to the roots of sadomasochism, for instance, and why people sometimes inflict pain upon themselves, because it's curious, but it just doesn't exist. Rather like the color red doesn't exist in external reality. In fact, no colors exist externally. Colors themselves are just because a particular segment of the electromagnetic spectrum is being reflected off the surface because of the chemical constituents of the object, the surface of the object that the light is bouncing back off. So, you know, you have a red hat sitting in front of you. Now you're seeing red there purely and simply because the red part of the spectrum, the whole of the rest of the visible light spectrum is being taken into the red hat, and the bit that's bouncing back is the red part of the spectrum. But the red is not in the hat. The hat is not red. But the red is nowhere because, you know, the red, the electromagnetic, the radiation, the light hits your retina. Your retina then converts that into an electronic signal, which then goes to the darkest part of your brain, the visual cortex behind the ears. And that then recreates the qualia of red within the darkest part of the brain. And you, whatever you are in your brain, whatever that point of consciousness is, perceives the red. But it is nowhere. It isn't anywhere. And this is the thing with everything we perceive. You know, there is nothing that we never, as I say in my talks, we never even interface directly with anything externally. People think that, you know, I'm sitting in a chair at the moment and my buttocks and my thighs are in contact with the chair. But of course they're not. The reason I'm hovering above the surface of the chair, and I'm hovering above it because of two effects. The Pauli exclusion principle, which if we have time, we go into later, but also because of electrostatic repulsion. within the atoms of my thighs and my backside and the atoms of the surface of the chair. So I never touch anything. So we go around thinking that we're interfacing with external reality, whereas we never touch it. We never really see it in the way we should see it. So we never really know exactly what really is out there. The only reason we believe that it is real is because it's consistent. It doesn't change. If I go to my bedroom and I left it last night, I go back, everything will be in the same location if people don't move things. And it's consistent. And it means if I can turn around to my wife and my wife can see the same things I see, we're then in what we call consensual reality. We both agree that the things we see in external reality are there, but it doesn't mean they're really there. We could be both having a collective hallucination.
There's enough evidence of that. I'm sitting here wondering how much I want to admit in the open air here on the show as to my own psychonautilus adventures and experiences. And well, let me ask you that question. So if you were to claim, hey, I've eaten psilocybin mushrooms all my life, I've tried LSD numerous times, I went and had an ayahuasca experience, what's the legalities on all of this right now? Where the psychonaut should you be concerned about discussing these things as people are about illicit drugs or illegal drugs and things like that?
Well, I think the question here in terms of psilocybin and particularly DMT, ayahuasca, of course, there are parts of the world where ayahuasca is legal, like Brazil and various other places. And also, as far as I understand it, it is legal in certain areas of the United States because it is considered to be a sacrament by certain religious groups like the Santa Dame movement. So there are areas where it's overlapped. But of course, these substances were not originally illegal. You know, they were made illegal because there were concerns by the authorities that they were putting people into different states of consciousness that were dangerous, maybe even to the status quo, I don't know. But effectively, DMT, for instance, as an example, you and I both know that in the early 1990s, Rick Strassman at the University of New Mexico was given money by the American government to do research into altered states of consciousness, specifically research the effects that individuals had when they took dimethyltryptamine. Now, again, many of your listeners out there, I am sure, will have read Rick's book, The Spirit Molecule. And in this, he discusses in very great detail how these individuals were catapulted into alternate realities that many believed were actually more real than this reality. Now, also, you probably will not be aware of this, and there are people I know that are working on this at the moment and are involved in this exercise, but there is research taking place in London at the moment at, I think it's Imperial College, where, again, there are a group of individuals who have volunteered to take intravenous doses of DMT. And one of the guys that I will be doing the event with in the caves in the Midlands in the UK was telling me about his experience because he's one of the volunteers. And it was intriguing because this very much fulfills the what I'm doing for my next book. It's when you meet entities in these altered states of consciousness, exactly what are they? You know, are they just projections of your own subconscious or do they have independent existence? And he was telling me, he said that the first time he took DMT, he found himself in what lots of psychonauts will say when they take DMT. He found himself catapulting out of his body at super speed and then finding himself located in the only thing he could describe as like a cage, a kind of golden cage. And because he had his consciousness was multi-aware, he could see what was happening outside the cage and inside the cage. And he said it was the first time he'd ever tripped like this. So he was quite shocked about where he was. And then suddenly these entities moved towards the edge of the cage as if they were expecting him. And he sensed they were expecting him. And one of the entities turned around him and said, "You shouldn't be doing this way. This is not the way to do it. We are very concerned about the approach you are taking at the moment." Then he found himself catapulted back into his body again with this image in his mind. 2 weeks later, he does his second session of DMT. He finds himself in the identical cage, identical location, with the same entity, again, looking at him and saying, I told you last time, you should not be doing this. Would you please tell the people involved in this experiment that it's not the way to do it? Now, as he said to me, this suggests that whatever the entities are out there, they're independent of us. They are part of some form of alternate reality, and they are in many ways concerned about what we're doing. Now, and of course, this could be to do with the way in which DMT works. You know, in terms of ayahuasca, there tends to be a kind of a more gradual movement into the altered states of consciousness with ayahuasca. And of course, one of my favorite stories about ayahuasca, and I don't know if you've heard this, you probably will have done, but when you know how ayahuasca works, and ayahuasca is made of the constituents of two plants, Banisteriopsis caapi, which is a vine, and Psychiatra viridis, which is a leaf. And the shamans and the indigenous peoples of the Amazon basin have for many years taken these two substances, mixed them together in a brew, in a tea, and they then drink this tea, and they have altered states of consciousness. But the intriguing thing is the psychoactive substance is in the leaves, in the Psychiatra viridis, and it's DMT. But the thing is that if you chose to just eat the leaves and they go into your stomach, however many of the leaves you eat, even though they contain DMT, you will never ever get an experience. And the reason you won't is that when it gets down into the stomach lining excretes something called monoamine oxidase. And what this does is it lines the stomach and stops the DMT crossing from the stomach into the bloodstream and then into the brain. Now, when you take ayahuasca, this doesn't happen, and it doesn't happen for an intriguing reason. It doesn't happen because the Banisteriopsis caapi contains substances such as harmaline, and these substances are actually an MAO, a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. So within the liquid, there is something that is there, almost designed to stop the MAO stopping the DMT crossing into the blood. Now, when the anthropologists spoke to the shamans about this and said, how did you decide on these two plants? Because they were intrigued because there are 80,000 different species of plants in the Amazon basin that we know of. And they picked the two that worked together perfectly. When the shamans were asked, they told a tale, and they said that when their ancestors, their shamanic ancestors, went shamanic traveling, they would meet entities in the upper world. And these shamanic totems, who were normally plants or snakes, would tell them that and would take them into this jungle area within the dream sequence, and pointed out these two plants and said, put these two together and you can allow non-shaman people to have the same experience as you're having. Now, what is this telling us about DMT itself? Because DMT is a very curious substance. It's in all plants. It's in all the mammals we've tested. It's in our own bodies. It's in our bloodstream. It's in our spinal fluid. And it is, interestingly enough, one of the few substances that cross what's called the blood-brain barrier. The brain is a very, very sensitive organ, and it can easily be poisoned. So what happens is literally the atoms round the brain are so close together that very few substances can come through, and only certain substances are allowed through. They seem to have a particular signal that the blood-brain barrier opens and lets them through. Substances like glucose, things that carry food to the brain. DMT can do that. Why? Why have we evolved in such a way that DMT within our own body is allowed to pass through this blood-brain barrier? It's as if we have evolved in some way to have DMT as a neurotransmitter. Now, again, I'm probably on a waffle here, but if you can just bear with me for a second. They have recently discovered, there are two things they've discovered in the brain, something called the sigma-1 receptors. and other things called the trace amine-associated receptors, the TAARS receptors. These receptor sites in the neurons of the brain are like keys in a lock. Certain keys can open certain locks. The neurologists have been intrigued for years as to what the role of particularly the trace amine-associated receptors are, because they couldn't find a reason for them until they tested them with DMT, and suddenly they work. So this suggests that DMT is in fact a neurotransmitter. And in fact, we have evolved, our brains have evolved to actually use DMT as a neurotransmitter. As a bit of background for your listeners, a neurotransmitter are the things that facilitate messages across the brain. Now, on top of that, around about 4 or 5 years ago, a lady called Jimo Borjigin at the University of Michigan was doing experiments with rats. And they actually tested the pineal glands of live rats. And for the first time ever, DMT was actually found in the pineal gland of a live mammal. Now, this is of such profound importance because it suggests that the pineal gland actually creates DMT or possibly synthesizes DMT from other substances such as melatonin. So suddenly here we have something that Rick Strassman said many years ago, that DMT is our reality modulator. So when you take these substances, what you don't realize is you're taking a substance that in fact is part of you. So in the final answer to your question, it means that both you and I and every living human being and every living mammal could effectively be arrested. If DMT is illegal in your country, you are actually carrying in your body an illegal substance.
Right.
But of course, what is really creepy about this, and the research for my new book is going in certain directions, is I'm very intrigued to discover that DMT is found in most animals and fish and everything else. It's not found in insects. And there has to be a reason for that. And I've yet to try and put the dots together as to why it is that insects do not have DMT. And the only thing I can think of is, you listen to most of the reports of DMT entities, they are distinctly insect-like.
I was just about to say that. The mantis is a common theme.
Wow. Yeah. And could it be that there's some kind of link here? As far as I'm aware, I'm the only writer that's made that link. I will apologize to any other writers that have. It's just I haven't read your work. But I do find it intriguing. And I'm also intrigued about the subtle symbolism here. The other things that people see insectoids, but they also seem to see in DMT journeys snakes. Now, right. You know, that seems to be a standard thing. And I know from my own experience with something called the lucid light device, which we'll talk on a little bit later, I had experiences with snakes as well. Now, what is happening here is I'm not quite sure, but most people, when they have these experiences, tend to say they normally see more than one snake, normally two, and they're normally coiling around each other. It's the caduceus. You know, the symbol of the caduceus, the two snakes going up at the pole in the center. If you look at the symbol, Masonic symbolism, many buildings will have the caduceus on the side. It's the symbol of it's Asclepion. It's the symbol of the medical profession. But if you look at that objectively, what you will see is that you have a pole going up, and at the top of the pole is a little circle and two wings either side of the top of the pole. And running up either side of the pole are two snakes that come together at the top. Now, I argue that the circle at the top is the pineal gland. The two wings are symbolic of the right and left hemispheres of the brain. The line up the middle is the spinal column. And the two snakes running up are the Ida and Pingala, which are the things that actually supposedly facilitate Kundalini experiences. But I also say that if you look at the shape of the snakes, it's reminiscent of DNA. And I think that what is happening is this is our own DNA communicating with us. And it is our DNA that is now trying to facilitate us moving to the next level of human evolution.
Now, this takes us straight to the UFO experience, straight to the idea of extraterrestrials and how the cosmos actually functions, whether or not we have to travel distances of thousands of light years or millions of light years even to get to other societies, and who's visiting planet Earth and all these craft that we're seeing. And is that a shared hallucination? I certainly had an experience with a friend at Daytona Beach. We both witnessed this giant rectangle hovering out over the ocean and then lost 5 hours of time, found ourselves back at home, not knowing how we got there, which was, you know, a couple hour drive from where we were. And then began predicting the future.
Really? What predicted? So you had lost time. Did anybody else witness the triangle, or was it just the two of you?
It was a rectangle. It was very bizarre. Not, you know, I've seen triangles as well and V-shaped craft. I'm one of those type of people that has more UFO experiences than most. And even, you know, it's in my past. And if you study ufology, you know that it follows generations. So I would not be surprised at all for me to be one of those people, because my dad was in Project Blue Book and was deep into this. So, and a Mason and into magic and all of that stuff. Well, not really into magic, that was mom. But so yes, we witnessed the thing together. We described it together. And strangely, the guy who experienced this UFO with me, which was my first major UFO experience, ended up living in every state that I ended up living in. It was so weird. I mean, it's just, we didn't know. As of right now, he's living in South Carolina. When I was in Kansas, he lived in Kansas. When I was in Texas, he lived in Texas. And neither one of us knew this. I finally found him on Facebook and was like, hey, you know, I want to do a show about this. And he didn't really remember enough to want to be confident enough to come on, because this was 1993 when this happened.
And your precognitions were things that subsequently came true as well, presumably.
Yeah, and the one thing that he said to me after, when I first contacted him again, was, do you remember seeing the future?
Wow.
And he didn't know that I had already been discussing having seen the future. Not that I knew it, not that I had a vision of it, but yet I haven't been wrong yet. You know, I predicted 9/11. Mm. I predicted George W. Bush being forced into office. I predicted everything that was going on in America before it happened. You know, 9/11 is definitely the big one that put me on the map, where everybody was like, how did you know? How did you know? And
so you had people you'd already discussed the 9/11 scenario with before it happened.
For years. Yeah.
Years.
Yeah.
Now that's powerful, isn't it? You know, that's irrefutable. I mean, people could argue that it's coincidence. Well, of course, you know, anybody can argue it's coincidence. You know, it's just a matter of how you play with statistics. But clearly, you know that you were seeing the future here. And one wonders if the UFO encounter and the lost time encounters, and we're both into ufology anyway, because we were discussing this earlier on, is that long lost time scenarios, I discuss in some detail in my book, The Labyrinth of Time. And I know friends of mine who have had periods of lost time were literally, they just don't know where they were. Now, where are you when you're in those scenarios? And indeed, does the encounter with the UFO open up certain channels of alternate communications within the brain? Does it open up the doors of perception in some way that allows your perception of time, your perception of what James called the specious present, the idea of exactly what your present moment is, broadens out to a few months or even to a few years? And you can actually feel the resonation of events that are about to happen in the future. Now, when you mentioned the UFO encounter, I know of something that happened with my mother that vindicates in many ways a lot of the ideas I've been developing over the years. And indeed, I write about in my book, Opening the Doors of Perception, because she, rather like you, she encountered a UFO. She didn't know what it was. She was a lady in her late 80s, partially sighted, widow. And my mother lived, I mean, she died last year, but she lived on a comparatively isolated village near Liverpool. And she was traveling onto the village, walking onto the village with my aunt. And my aunt stopped to tie her shoelace. And when she did so, my mother looked up over my aunt's head into the distance. She phoned me up that evening to tell me what she'd seen, and she said she saw in the sky what she could only describe as a circle of smoke. And the circle of smoke started to coalesce and started to wrap around itself. And then it got to almost a point, a black point, and then it shot off at great speed towards North Wales, so going in the kind of a southwesterly direction. Now, my mother doesn't know anything about UFOs, although I've been interested in them since I was 10 or 11 years of age. My mother doesn't. She's never been interested. In fact, she's always dismissed them as being complete nonsense. So she knows none of the tropes. She knows none of the symbols or anything else within ufology. So she tells me about this. And then 2 or 3 days later, one morning, she phones me up. She's in a state of hysteria. She lives on her own. And she said she woke up in the middle of the night and she was in a state of what we know to be sleep paralysis, but she didn't. So she's in a state of sleep paralysis. And she's looking towards the door of her bedroom, and she always closes the door, but the bedroom door was open. And then she said, I looked at the door, and then suddenly I saw a series of spindly fingers come round the edge of the door and this little creature poke its head round. And she described that the creature, and it's emblazoned on my memory. She said it had huge black eyes, looked like an insect. It had two holes for a nose, its nostrils, and a slit for a mouth. And she said it saw me and realized I was awake, looked concerned, and dodged back again. And she said, Tony, what did I see? Well, of course, you and I know she saw a classic gray. Indeed, she saw the archetypal grey that was on the cover of Whitley Strieber's book, Communion. But she doesn't know that symbolism. So either this is something that's deep, it's either a kind of a Jungian archetype, or it is something that is deeply rooted within our own psychology that we see under those circumstances. But whatever she saw, it had independent existence. Now, what is then strange about this whole case is that she then started seeing little children in the house. She said she was being followed around by small, she called them children. And she said they used to sing to her. Now, when this started, she then said that there was an old man in the kitchen and he used to nod at her. And I quickly realized that she was actually developing something called Charles Bonnet syndrome. She was partially sighted, and it is a known phenomenon. The explanation, in raised commas, is that they hold hallucinations created by the brain because the body is losing sight. It just creates hallucinations. Utter nonsense. It's just that is just a pat excuse. Nobody knows what hallucinations are. Nobody knows what causes hallucinations in any shape or form. They just pretend they do. They give it a nice Latin sounding term, and they turn around and they say they've explained it. They haven't. Nobody knows what hallucinations are. So she's seeing these hallucinations. And Charles Bonnet syndrome is something that people have as a precursor for Alzheimer's disease. So I took my mother to see the doctor, and I told the doctor they need to check her for Alzheimer's. Now, what is happening in Alzheimer's disease, and this is where it starts to get very, very intriguing, is that the reason that Alzheimer's disease has the effect it does is the brain starts to generate little things called amyloid plaques. And these amyloid plaques literally latch onto the neurons of the brain and they explode the microtubules within the brain. The microtubules just get destroyed. It's rather analogous to the back of a radio where the valves have been destroyed, but other signals then can come through. In other words, the valves have been destroyed. The neurological pathways have been destroyed, which allows the brain to start to attune into, and again, I'm the only writer in the world that's discussing this, and it will be in my new book, is that there are two structures in the brain. There's the neurological structures, which we believe is where intelligence is, where communications take place. But the neurons are only around about a tenth of the number of cells in the brain. You know the old tale, people say you only use 10% of your brain. This is the reason. 10% of your brain is neurons. 90% of your brain is something called the astroglial network. They're glial cells. Now, glial is German for glue. And what they believe is the glial cells hold the neurons in place. Recent research has shown that the glial cells actually are not useless. they communicate with each other, but they don't communicate with each other chemically like the neurons do. They communicate non-locally using quantum physics effects. Now, what I think is happening is that people, when they start to develop Alzheimer's or temporal lobe epilepsy, migraine, autism, various other illnesses, schizophrenia, what is taking place is the neurons themselves are losing their effectiveness, which means that consciousness starts to attune into the astroglial network, which works non-locally and is attuned to what we could call the Akashic field, the zero point field. Now, again, many of you may be aware of something called orchestrated objective reduction, which is a theory of consciousness suggested by Stuart Hammerhoff of the University of Arizona and Professor Roger Penrose, who's a British mathematician. And the two of them have argued that, and this is where it gets intriguing, that quantum physics effects take place within the structures within the neurons, the structures I just mentioned before that get destroyed by the amyloid plaques. So it's rather as if the microtubules are tuning into one level of energy and consciousness. The astroglial network is like the broader field of information. It's almost like VHF rather than normal radio waves. And I think this is what's taking place. I think what is happening is these people are attuning into a broader level of reality. The senses are broadening out. Literally, their doors of perception have been opened. And I think this is the argument I'll be putting forward in my new book. In summary, what I mean by that is that we have two, the normal way that we perceive reality and the way in which consciousness functions is neurologically based. So it works neurologically and it works neurochemically. But there is another network within the brain called the glial network. And the glial network works on non-local quantum physics principles. And indeed, it is that network that actually broadens our ability to attune into a wider field of information. Now, indeed, again, I would argue that probably your UFO encounter probably opened up certain channels of communication within your brain that opened up maybe the glial network in some way, which allowed you to attune into what could be argued is the fifth dimension of space-time. So there's time outside of time, where everything is a continual present or a continual now. Therefore, the future already exists and is existing at all times, and you attune into that.
Well, definitely in the second hour, we'll discuss some of the methods that I have used to reach new states of consciousness and understanding. I decided to hold all that off until we get off into the member section because, well, it's just us and the family in there. So
I can't wait.
Nicer. Oh, not a lot nicer, but you know, it's family. It feels comfy and it's home. So if you guys want, you know, come on over to freemantv.com and subscribe, get the other hours of these shows, plus support this effort of mine to keep these consciousness thoughts coming to you. The only way this stays on the air is through your support. So please come to freemantv.com and subscribe and check it out because it's worth it, guys. Longest running radio show here, our podcast in this field. Lots and lots of stuff deep into that. You have blown my mind, Anthony Peake. Oh my gosh. I can't wait to dig deeper and throw some of these things at you in the other hour because this hour just, man, it just laid it out there because this idea of consciousness existing outside of a living organism, you know, why does your heart beat? Why does your brain think? Where do these thoughts come from? These are the critical questions that need to be answered as we're moving into this new 21st century of clones and drones and mind transfer technologies. And is that even possible to put your consciousness into a computer, transmit it? We discussed that. these ideas are the ones that we're going to have to deal with in the 21st century as virtual reality, augmented reality start coming into play. And we have as real of a real reality inside as outside. And then with the quantum dynamics, and we have moved into the age of quantum consciousness and this idea that, well, does it even exist if you don't observe it?
Absolutely.
You'll never know, will you? That is the amazing things that you will find within the works of Anthony Peak. 11 books coming, and so many of them that you want to get. I highly recommend getting over to anthonypeak.com, picking up Opening the Doors of Perception. Get your copy from anthonypeak.com, not Amazon, so that you support him. Because the majority of the money goes to Amazon in other ways. If you go to his website, you go to anthonypeak.com and you pick up a copy of Opening the Doors of Perception, not only do you get that, you support his works better, but Anthony will autograph it for you and send it off to you, which is amazing. And as a collector, I love that. So definitely purchase these works there at anthonypeak.com. And those of you, where was the experience with the lucid light and all of that happening again?
Yeah, it's happening in a small town called Kidderminster, which is west of Birmingham in the center of England. And it's building up to being something extremely special. If it goes well, we're planning to have a series of them. And effectively this place seems to be very active in terms of poltergeist activity. I was talking to one of the research psychologists working there, and he was telling me that he's seen genuine poltergeist activity. Not only that, but teleportations taking place there and apports taking place. So it's going to be something extremely different. And as I say, please try and get along if you can. I'll be placing something about it on my Facebook wall as soon as I know. We're traveling up to look at the place next week when I'm going with a couple of the academics involved. And we're just going to have a look around. But it's the lucid light devices that we will have with us that really is the leading edge stuff, because I believe these hypnagogic light devices, usually known as Lucias, genuinely stimulate the pineal gland to synthesize endogenous dimethyltryptamine. And I think I've put a structure together that might explain how it does that.
And folks, that is the future. Electronic drugs, virtual sex, clones, internal life, everything Rael promised us in Congress. It's all coming. but it's true, isn't it, Anthony? I mean, this is that moment that every dystopian book begins at, right? We've got the AI coming, the clones, the robot.
Well, the thing is, as well as this, what I think because we can now appreciate, I mean, one of the things I contributed a chapter to a book on panpsychism a few years ago. The idea that we're all one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively, as Bill Hicks argued. And in my chapter, I discuss about virtual reality, and I discuss about how you can mentally place yourself in a scenario. If you work with virtual reality, I mean, for instance, I have a virtual reality headset here that I use to actually understand how alternate realities work. And what I suggest is, imagine a scenario that you could create a virtual reality headset, as we have now, with stereo sound and everything else as well. But on top of that, you also have a bodysuit that has tactile feedback. So you, on the screen, when you move your hands, it feeds back from the gloves you have on. So you have a virtual one-to-one movement within the three-dimensional simulated reality, okay? So you are moving in your body, and the body on the screen looks like your own body, and you're in this three-dimensional reality. That is stunning, and that is way within our technological capability now, okay? But imagine, I then put two twists on this, and I say, imagine a scenario whereby you are living in a virtual reality game of your own life, that your own life has been digitized in a virtual reality environment from the moment of your birth to the moment of your death. And you go into that in your virtual reality suit. But not only that, but all your memories of your previous life are wiped clean. So you live your next life as if it's the first life. And you have no idea, A, that you're in a virtual reality scenario, or indeed that you have lived this many, many times before. Now, this is my cheating the ferryman hypothesis, which I presented in my first book. But in my first book, virtual reality had not taken off. I wrote that book effectively about 1999. It came out in 2006. I didn't have the knowledge of the technology and the understanding of the technology of how that could really work. Because we all play games. You know, some of the games I play in virtual reality now are uncannily real. You've got to actually shake yourself out of it, because sometimes they are so real that you forget that there's a reality that you're in playing the game. And if you forgot that, you would really be lost. So imagine that you live your life again. Now imagine that when you're playing this game, in this virtual reality game, the game of life, there is a game player, the you that's outside of the game, that is aware of the fact that you're the game player. Now imagine that that you is your own higher self. Imagine that that you has lived your life many times before and knows the mistakes you made last time. Is that the voice in your head that warns you to not do things? Is that the why we sometimes feel we can see the future? For instance, your precognition of 9/11 and your other precognitions, could those precognitions actually be memories? And what happens is, as you were starting to get towards 9/11, there were other stimulants that were reminding you and thinking, something's going to happen. I remember this from somewhere in my past. I remember this. And then you suddenly go, God, there's going to be planes that are going to hit the Twin Towers. And suddenly you start to remember. And I argue that this is how precognitions actually work. That they are your memories. They're not precognitions at all. They're actually memories from the last time you experienced this. Now, if you have your own higher self, I call the higher self the daemon. Your game player is your daemon. You in the game, I call the Eidolon. And the Eidolon, as I say, has no memories that they've lived the life before. And of course, this is analogous to Groundhog Day, the movie. In Groundhog Day, the movie, you remember, Connors, he lives the same day over and over again. But he's a daemon and an Eidolon, because he's in the game and can remember what he did in the last game. The day before, he remembers, so therefore adapts and adopts his behaviors to the next day. But I think we are split personalities. We have a daemon that is outside of ourselves, that is our own immortal self. And I discuss this in detail in my book, The Daemon, A Guide to Your Extraordinary Secret Self. And I, again, if anybody has read my works, you will know I do the science. I'm not just spouting this out because I'm channeling it from the planet Tharg. I've come to these conclusions not because I wanted to come to them. I've literally read the science, looked at people's experiences, and then tried to put together a structure, a scientific explanation as to how these things may occur. And it was only then that I thought, gee, this could explain in near-death experiences why people have panoramic life reviews. It could explain why people have deja vu sensations. It could explain the concept of the guardian angel. And I genuinely believe, and again, I keep saying I'm the only writer on the planet doing this, but I genuinely believe I'm the only writer in the planet that can actually attempt an explanation at every single esoteric belief, every single altered state of consciousness, every single idea of precognitions. I've got an answer for them all. My cheating the ferryman hypothesis explains them all. I may be completely wrong, but it does explain them, and it explains them in a scientific way.
Without a doubt, folks, believe me, everything Anthony Peake says is sourced, resourced, and databased for you to go back and get the full details. So, you know, share in his pain as he tries to explore this reality with the rest of the world, and people don't want to think about thinking. because you absolutely, Anthony, database everything, resource and source everything with bibliographies and links, and make sure everyone can find the peer-reviewed material that is necessary to say this is the truth. And what we know for sure is that the answers are almost always simple.
And the It's always the simple answers are always, it's Occam's razor. You know, the simple answers are normally the ones. So for instance, when you have a deja vu sensation, there are somewhere in the region 72 different explanations for deja vu. 72. All of them make no sense. They're irrational. Some of them have been disproven, like the visual pathways hypothesis, Robert Efron, 1962. You read any book on psychology, they will cite this. Even now, they will cite that this is the explanation. It is not. It was disproved years ago by research done by somebody called Akira O'Connor at the University of Leeds, where they found the people who are born blind have déjà, what's the word? Is it senti? I'm not quite, my French isn't good enough, but they already hear things. So they hear something, they hear it again. And the pathways in the brain are completely different for hearing rather than sight. So they're back to the trying to explain it again using all these crackpot theories. Mine's not a crackpot theory. I'm saying that déjà vu is exactly what it feels like. It feels like you've lived this before. The standard definition of déjà vu is something along the lines of it is a memory of something from something that occurred in an indefinite period in your past. This is exactly what it is. It's a kind of a memory. And you relive it and you think, what's going on here? Now, I'm going to turn the ball back on you now, because I know that you've had quite a few interesting experiences yourself. And I'm keen to hear about your experiences that either vindicate or discredit or disprove the ideas I'm putting forward. So I'm keen to just hear a little bit about you, Freeman, and what has happened to you in terms of these experiences.
And I am thoroughly excited to do that. And we're going to pick that up on the other side, though. And folks, so trust in this. Trust that you know. Trust that you have the truth about what's going on in reality and that you can make the proper choices. Trust in your intuitions and your synchronicities, the things that are outside of your conscious thoughts and outside of the things that you think you need to be doing to make reality work. And maybe we can finally transform this planet into a human consciousness instead of the insectoid consciousness that we seem to be existing in now. So I want us all to break through these doors of perception, open this door wide, and start to see the reality that is outside of reality and the God above God. So yes, we are going to dig deep into that on the other side. I'm going to let it all loose. I'll admit to it all. I don't care.
Hey. This is going to be it, guys. Longest show ever in terms of podcasts of this kind of type. And Freeman's going to really let us know what really started it all and what generated his fascinating journey, which he was telling me about earlier, which sounds absolutely intriguing. And I'm keen to know more about this. Let's stop listening to me. I'm waffling on like mad, but this is the guy you want to listen to.
All right. And I always want to say thank you, Steve. Steve, the producer here, keeping the good guests rolling through. If you have any questions, guest suggestions, or anything, write producersteve@freemantv.com. That is the email, producersteve@freemantv.com, to get your guest on here and let me talk to them, because I love doing this. And, you know, thank you, Steve, for keeping this thing rolling. And folks, make sure to like, share, and rate everything so that the rest of the world can see it, because we live in an algorithmic world, and the more you like stuff, the more everybody else will like it. That's just the way it works. So thank you all so much for tuning in here every week and keeping things going. I hope you're going to come on over to the website, freemantv.com. Subscribe, check it out, get deep. You know, you can get a week for free if you subscribe to recurring payments, or just jump in for a month and see what it's like. I guarantee you're going to love it. And anthonypeak.com. Go over there, get the books. You want to check this stuff out, guys, and order it straight from Anthony there so that you can get his autograph and be a collector like me. So with that, we are going to bounce over into the members section and get deep into the mind of Freeman. Oh, here we go.
Wow.